from the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to start with Senate Bill 480 today. Then we'll go to 602, and then Senate Bill 291, and then Senate Bill 745. In that order. So I'd like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 480. You could give us a summary, Lynn?
Yes. Senate Bill 480 requires the Department of Education to provide assistance to school districts, government agencies, and community groups to encourage participation in the United States Department of Agriculture after-school meal and snack program. It appropriates money from general fund to the Oregon Department of Education for grants and administration of the grant program. There are amendments to this. The Dash 2 amendments would allow the Department of Education to award grants and enter into contracts with public and private entities to provide assistance and administer the grants. And the amendment also changes the requested general fund appropriations for grants from $175,000 to $150,000 and lowers the allocations for the administration of the grants from $75,000 to $30,000.
Okay, and Senator Bonamici, did you want to...
I just wanted to make just a comment about this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill has my name on it, and this issue came to my attention when I was have been serving on the Supporting Student Success Team, which is a group of people looking at after-school programs, generally considered to be extended learning opportunities. And through that work, our group has really focused on nutrition and the importance of nutrition for students. And it really came to our attention that in the process, which you'll hear more about when we hear Senate Bill 291, of learning where the after-school programs are in the state and how they're funded, that there's an opportunity for more schools to get additional help with serving meals to students, and this bill is intended to further that goal, Mr. Chair and committee members, and you'll hear the details from people who will be testifying, but in general, this reimbursement program is designed for youth in low-income areas to make sure that they get meals that they need. And I look forward to the testimony, and I'm really pleased that you scheduled this bill for a hearing today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right, so we have a couple of people signed up here. I would like to call you up as panels and urge you to be as brief as possible so we can get everybody. If you have written testimony, all you have to do is hand that in. Don't feel the need to read it aloud. So let's start with Beth Unverzack, Annie Kircher, Michael Vetter. Come on up.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having us here. And the first bill that we submitted, Senate Bill...
Go ahead and start off with your name.
Okay, so Beth Unverzott, Oregon After School for Kids, and the lead for the Supporting Student Success Grant and that over the last 18-month period. I'm going to have Annie Kirshner and Mike Vetter talk about Senate Bill 480.
Thank you, Chair House and the committee, for the chance to testify in this bill. My name is Annie Kirshner. I work at Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon. I coordinate our child nutrition work. Senate Bill 480 is really essential to ensuring that all kids have the nutrition that they need to learn and to grow. Currently, half of all students in Oregon are qualifying for free and reduced price meals. A national poll found that 86% of teachers report their students are frequently coming to school hungry. School meals are a really essential part in the fight to eliminate childhood hunger. But for kids whose parents work until 6 p.m., that stretch of time between lunch and when they get home and have dinner, if there is dinner there for them, is far too long. Fortunately, there's federal funds available in the form of the after-school meal and snack program, which helps provide meals to kids who are in after-school programming, especially in low-income areas. not only does this give them that nutritional boost that they need to really stay engaged during that time, but it also, we found, helps draw kids in the door and increases their chances of coming to the after-school program, especially during that three-hour time when we know that kids are the most at risk. Unfortunately, not all programs who could be serving the meals are doing so. Recent research by Oregon Ask found that there were 125 schools in Oregon who are providing after-school programs to kids and are in qualifying low-income neighborhoods who are not offering the program. So that's 40% of those schools who could very easily be getting federal reimbursement for feeding kids. We've found that once a program is up and running, the federal reimbursement that they get for each meal served is enough to sustain them. But the upfront costs that they incur in having to get the equipment necessary, pass the health inspections, get the staff in place, is often so high that it prevents organizations from even considering operating this program. Senate Bill 480 would provide small grants to help cover some of those upfront costs for the organizations. We know from providing similar grants in the past that this approach is successful. We offered grants for the past several years for summer food programs and have had a small amount of seed money from the Gates Foundation to do so for after school. Not only did we see new programs open a significant number of new feeding sites in areas where previously kids didn't have access to the meals, but we also saw the number of meals served increase. And the thing that's really encouraging about that is that it brought in a significant number of federal dollars. So for each meal served, federal dollars were leveraged into the community. Those grants that we previously gave out, there was a 374% return on investment by those dollars that were put in place. Based on a survey that we did at our organization last week, a third of school districts and organizations that are operating child nutrition programs told us that they would start or expand after-school meal service if additional funds were available. So we know that there are lots of organizations that serve kids that are out there that would like to be giving them that nutrition that they need after school but have this barrier in place, and we're excited about the opportunity that, this bill would, present. So we are strongly in support of this bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you. My name is Mike Vetter. I'm the food service director for Central School District, which is in Independence in Monmouth, just a stone's throw from Salem. I'm also a resident of Albany, Oregon, and when I had my first tour of Central School District, in comparison of Albany, Albany has its good areas and bad areas. Well, seeing Independence in Monmouth, I was quite surprised by the amount of poverty that I saw. Many of my schools are 70 to 75% free and reduced percent, which is very, very high. Many of our kids are needy. And at the time, we didn't have an after-school program. And Marion Polk County Food Share, Rose Walker, is an ex-member of that team, but she came to me and said, Mike, you guys need to do something here. And I didn't realize how bad it was until after she showed me and talked about some of the numbers. So I had the opportunity to start an after-school program. Last year, we served about 17,000 meals, almost 20,000 meals of after-school meals. This year, because of budget cuts, we are serving right now about one quarter of that right now, unfortunately, because of the lack of funding to pay for staffing and things like that. So last year, we were serving on average about 60 kids per six sites. This year, we're serving about 10. The reason why is parents cannot afford the after-school cost, even though it is subsidized by the school district. Prior to me starting, we were in the hole $75,000 in food service funds, which is about three staff members, three new people. Last year, we actually broke even, which is the first time in our history, which is very exciting, but it's still very scary. And the reason why I'm here is to talk about equipment, because equipment's kind of one of those things where, you know, like in your at home, you know, life's going good, and all of a sudden you have a medical emergency. Well, what's in food service, a medical emergency is the breakdown of your food service equipment, which, as you can see on this little document here, if I lose two pieces of equipment, it's about $10,000. Well, it's $10,000 that I don't have, unfortunately. I've had the opportunity to tour other school districts in Oregon, from the very small to the largest school districts around, and I was surprised to see how old some of the equipment is. Some of the equipment is as old as I am, or even as old as you guys, believe it or not. I mean, and it's pretty, okay. Yeah. So there's some steam ran, you know, products out there still that are run on steam or coal, I swear, but, you know, it's very unfortunate. Now, what we do is, you know, there's a lot of duct tape, and you got to hold things together, but it's very, very expensive. And so what we have to do sometimes, when we have a breakdown, we actually have to pick up this 2,000-pound piece of equipment, like that's in one school, and say, okay, we're just going to move this equipment over here just to temporarily fill in the gap, because I don't have the money to purchase new equipment. It's either, you know, have somebody not get hired, because, you know, to me that's more important, essentially. You know, I want to hire people to get this economy going again, but if I'm spending on equipment, it's not going to work that way. So I just wanted to kind of make you aware of that, and that, you know, any sort of help that we do have is greatly appreciated. I will tell you that I am very thankful for what we have right now from the government. I do think it's a pretty fair for the food. I am able to run a program that doesn't run this in the hole, but it still is very difficult when that medical emergency happens. And, you know, unfortunately, like with American families, when we have a medical emergency, sometimes it can bankrupt you, and that's kind of what we're looking at if we do lose a piece of equipment. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I find it hard to believe you have refrigerators from 1957.
We do. I just got rid of one, actually, two of them.
Questions?
No, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Jimmy Arundoto, Jeff Milks, and Patty Whitney Wise.
Good afternoon. Jeff Milkus. I'm the South Services Manager for Portland Parks and Recreation. And that was a hard act to follow, and I promise we won't talk anything in terms of the age of equipments or our programs. For over the last 100 years, Portland Parks and Recreation has run programs in the summer for children, recreation, educational, and generally fun activities. For the last number of decades, we've long been an advocate for access to and providing free and reduced lunches, providing nutrition for children in the summers. In addition to the summers, we've gotten into, because of the need, into after-school programs. Last summer, or two summers ago, we did about 63,000 lunches. Last summer, in spite of budgetary pressure, we were able to provide about 78,000. And it's something with our partners, nonprofits in Multnomah County, that we feel like we do pretty well. During the school year, we realized that the need really exists for this kind of service and the access to it. And as a result, we, in spring of 10, started a program at one of our community centers. And it quickly drew steam that it was very clear that there was a real demand and a need for access points in those neighborhoods, particularly in the north and in the outer east part of Portland. So we continued that program only to lose some funding as a result of a nonprofit unable to assist us further. Just to summarize, I guess the message I'd like to leave with you from my bureau's perspective is that we have 13 community centers, and of those centers, we now have after-school programs where meals are provided in two, and we would like to expand that. Our challenge is the funding for the staffing and the outreach. We believe that we could do, on a school year basis, upwards of 10,000 lunches per site per year, or 10,000 meals per site per year. It's a hefty goal, but I think we can do it. With that said, I won't take any more of your time, and I appreciate your consideration.
Good afternoon. My name is Jaime Arredondo. I come from the Farm Worker Housing and Development Corporation. It's a nonprofit based here in the Willamette Valley. Our families have greatly benefited from the after-school meal and snack program. In 2010 alone, we served over 15,000 meals to our kids. These are kids living at our sites, but also kids from the outside community. And this has been a huge help. Prior to 2009, we weren't serving any meals. And we actually conducted a study among our families that showed that 44% of our families were food insecure and 14% were going hungry. These are farm worker families we're talking about. So this has been just a tremendous help. And I wanted to share a couple quotes from some of the beneficiaries of this work. This is from a mother in Woodburn, Oregon. I believe there was only one school that provided free lunches during the school year. It is good that you are also open to the community because my husband is barely working. My girls are always checking the clock, making sure we don't miss it. Here's one from a second grader, talking to one of our staff. Teacher, at the school lunch, I did not eat my green beans. Now my mom sits here with me and makes sure I eat them. There are many other sites that could really benefit from this program, including some of our sites that are not don't have this program. So I really ask for your support of Senate Bill 480. Thank you.
Patty Whitney Wise, Oregon Hunger Task Force and Partners for Hunger Free Oregon. As you can see, this is a very valuable program. It's mostly federally funded, but that barrier is the startup costs. And this is a very modest proposal, but would make a big difference for many, many children in our state. So we hope you'll seriously consider passing this on to Ways and Means for us. Thank you.
Patty, questions, comments?
I just want to make a brief comment, Mr. Chair. I wanted to clarify, in case there's any questions about the equipment piece, what we're trying to do is really break down the barriers and to getting these programs into our communities. And we found that one of the barriers was if the school didn't or the site did not have the equipment, they couldn't start the program. And so that's why the bill allows for a purchase of necessary equipment. Just to clarify, in case anyone had any questions about that. Thank you.
Joyce Doherty from the department. Joyce.
Chair Hass, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joyce Doherty, and I am the director of the Child Nutrition Programs. And with me is Darcy Miller, a child nutrition specialist who works with the After School Meals Program. And I'm here to discuss Senate Bill 480. You are familiar with the National School Lunch Program and are aware that there are three areas with the National School Lunch Program that really impact our nation as well as the health of our children. The first is that it was developed for national security, for health and wellness, as well as for academic growth and development for children. And with what we're looking at with Senate Bill 480, we're looking at extending the nutritional needs of children throughout the day after school is out by offering them a meal, a full meal, after school, during an after-school program. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, they provide the regulations for the program, and what we want to be able to do is to help increase the number of sponsors. There are at least 60 school districts that have a combined total of 184 sites that currently offer the after-school snack program through the National School Lunch Program. These sites could easily participate in the child care and adult food program, supper and snack meal program. And but these sites, many of them are not able to participate because they lack the funds for equipment, as was mentioned earlier in another testimony from another school district, and they're not able to participate because of limited numbers of staff. And what the snack program does, it offers two meal components. The supper program offers five. So a student is able to get a full meal through the after-school meals and snack program. In 2009, an Emerson Hunger Fellow student conducted a study in the Oregon After School Meals Program. We were one of the, just on the side, we were one of the first states in the nation to offer this program, one of eight states, the only state west of the Mississippi. And one of the things that they identified was that offering a snack, a two-meal component, was not enough. Many students needed the five-meal component. They were able to show that they were able to attract children, both adolescents as well as young children, to after-school programs where they were able to participate in studies clubs as well as recreational sports and activities. the dollars that are provided by this bill will not reduce or impact the federal program. The state dollars will not impact ODE's school state fund budget, and this bill will help support small school districts and nonprofits. In summary, the Oregon Department of Education, the Child Nutrition Programs, we work very closely with Partners for Hunger Free Oregon, with Oregon Asked. We have other partners, and this bill will allow us to be very responsive to not only school districts, but also nonprofits and communities. ODE, the Department of Child Nutrition, we are willing, ready, and able to implement Senate Bill 480. The bill benefits children, communities, and our schools. We're happy to answer any questions.
Can you, I know a lot of this is going on now. Can you put this in perspective and kind of describe what the difference would be between now and the implementation of this bill with then the attached money? Where would we see that? How would we measure that?
He does it.
This must be why I'm here. My name is Darcy Miller, and I am a program specialist for the Oregon Department of Education. I'm a child nutrition specialist, and I do administer the after-school meals and snacks program on behalf of our department. The difference is that there are barriers to participation for either current sponsors that want to add sites that are not ready to go equipment-wise or with sanitation inspections that need to be funded, or new sponsors, new organizations that want to apply and become part of the after-school meals and snacks program who just simply don't have the resources or the equipment to take on a supper program or a snack program. I'm going to give you, for instance, Ontario has a Boys and Girls Club. It's called the Boys and Girls Club of the Western Treasure Valley. And they have currently come onto our program with just simply snack only. And the problem is that they can't do a supper because they don't have the facilities to do a supper. They barely have the facilities to do a two-component snack. They have an old refrigerator that has a hasp lock on it that, you know, to keep it closed, it has a hasp lock on it. I mean, this is just not something that, you know, we like to see out there, but it is the reality of it. They don't have a three-compartment sink, and the sanitarians out there are not going to approve them to serve a five-component meal without some way to wash dishes. So this type of funding, even though it maybe is not a tremendous amount of dollars, would make a huge impact for either sponsors that want to come on the program or current sponsors who want to add new sites to the program because they don't have the wherewithal to do the startup.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Now, this bill, which is destined for Ways and Means, eventually, with the amendment, has a $180,000 price tag on it. What is the federal match with that, or how will that work?
Okay. Chair Haas, members of the committee, there is no federal match for this program. However, when you look at the number of dollars that will be brought into the communities, it is very substantial. I don't have those figures with me right now, but it's very clear that by bringing in this program, there is an expansion of participation in terms of meals, but it also increases the economy of that school district. We have many school districts, for example, who are in the black by being a member or by participating in the after-school meals and supper program. So it will really help the local budget of many school districts as well as nonprofits.
It will help the local budget.
It will, in a sense, because right now, if a school district that's participating in the National School Lunch Program, if they're not able to meet their cost, state dollars are used to help, or local dollars are used to help them have a balanced budget. And many school districts can be in the red for up to $75,000 or sometimes $100,000. And they're needing to use local dollars or state dollars to help balance that budget. And we show that many of the school districts that participate in this program are operating in the black. In other words, they're not supplementing their child nutrition budgets with local or state dollars because they're self-supporting. This program helps to keep them in the black so that they're able to be fiscally sound as a nutrition program.
Okay, questions, comments from the, for the department?
Just Senator a quick Bonavita. Comment. I'm not going to ask Darcy Hold the refrigerators, but I did want to just thank Darcy and Joyce. They were very helpful in crafting the bill and identifying where the needs were. And the bottom line, Mr. Chair and Committee, is that if we can get these programs started, that it will bring in the federal money mm-hmm. for the meals and will help kids across the state. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I note that last year, $5.4 million. Federal money was brought into school districts, nonprofits, and local businesses.
Correct.
With a task force.
And you can see that there, Chair Haas and members of the committee, you can see that there is a substantial increase in terms of dollars that are being brought into our state as well as our communities as a result of this program.
And if I could add, Chair Haas, you had asked what the difference could be. It's not matching dollars. Joyce was absolutely correct in that. But what it could do, again, for instance, for the Boys and Girls Club of the Western Treasure Valley in Ontario, is currently they're getting reimbursement for a two-component meal, which is 74 cents per snack. What if they could get money to improve their kitchen facilities and serve a five-component meal, that reimbursement jumps up to this year $2.92 and change for each meal that they would serve. And they're serving about 160 kids out there right now for supper and for snack in the after-school program. And they would both increase the nutritional boost to the kids out there, and it's a very needy area, and the dollar-wise that we would be passing through the state to that particular nonprofit organization would increase almost four times what we're giving them currently.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. Maybe I missed it somewhere. Is there any cap on the federal dollars available?
Chair Haas, Senator Morris, no, there isn't. It's an entitlement program, and as long as there is a need and that we serve children, then we are reimbursed. So there is no cap. It's an entitlement program, and I think that that's one of the reasons why we want to be able to use these federal dollars to help not only feed children, but also to help our communities as well.
Hello.
Senator Morris.
And I would gather that the requirements of the federal grant would not provide for the purchase of equipment?
Chair Haas, Senator Morris, that's correct. What we provide through the USDA program is a reimbursement of the meal. As Darcy said earlier, there's a certain amount that we reimburse for a two-component meal for snack, and then there's the reimbursement for the full meal. So we are reimbursing a reimbursable meal. We do not have, there's no budget in there for equipment and supplies.
And if I might add, Senator Morris, there are no startup costs. That is the barrier at this point in time to start. Once they start receiving reimbursement, usually those programs can make stuff work. It's the startup of the program, which this bill directly addresses, is crucial.
And can I also add to that, Chair Haas and Senator Morris? The other part to this is the sanitation component, because many of potential sponsors are not able to meet the sanitation requirements to start their program. And so this bill will allow them the dollars necessary to meet the sanitation requirements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Philip, I have you down as supporting this. Did you want to testify?
Can we breathe?
Sure.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Philip Kennedy Wong, representing the Oregon Food Bank. I'll keep my comments brief. I've asked the committee staff to pass out to you just a little background on a study that the Oregon Food Bank did over the last year that gives you a sense of the people that are being served through the 20 regional food banks and the 947 partner agencies that distribute emergency food boxes. And the reason why I wanted to share that with you is I wanted to highlight some of the alarming facts with respect to hungry children, just to give you the context of which Senate Bill 480 is in. So just a few quick things I want to pull out for you, and then I'll just end my testimony. 33% of those receiving emergency food services are children. 30% of households with children report cutting or reducing the size of a child's meal, and of that percentage, 37% do so every month, which is a 7% increase from 2008, which was the last time we did this study. And just to give you a sense how we did this study, we had surveys that were distributed out to our partner agencies, of which we received roughly, I think, 4,000 surveys that came back. And the last thing I wanted to leave you with is, of the hungry Oregonians that receive food through the Oregon Food Bank Network, households with children are the largest group served, and that's roughly 42%. So the Oregon Food Bank does encourage you to make a small investment in fighting hunger among children, and we hope that you will support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 480, and I'd like to open up a work session on Senate Bill 480.
Mr. Chair, I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 480, dated March 8, 2011.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the -2 amendments dated March 8, 2011, of Senate Bill 480. Any discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. The -2 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 480 as amended without recommend. Well, I'm not sure I want to make that motion. I make the motion, Mr. Chair, that we move it with a due pass recommendation to Ways and Means Committee by prior reference.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 480 with a due pass recommendation as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 480 moves to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 480, and I would like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 602. We're honored by the presence of three state senators today. Senators Courtney, Verger, and Atkinson are here.
For the record, I'm Senator Joanne Verger, representing Senate District 5. Chair Hass, members of the committee, thank you very much for holding this hearing today. It is about Oregon Studies curriculum in the Oregon public schools. Oregon Studies is a required course today. It is a course that teaches history, economics, civics, and geography that is specific to the state of Oregon. Today it is taught in the fourth grade. However, let me tell you that the extent to which it's taught depends very much on the ability of the school and the teachers to present that course. And so you get a wide variety of the way that the course is taught throughout in the fourth grade. Some teachers have more time than others, and I don't want anything in this testimony to in any way insinuate that the pride and the respect that I have for the teaching profession. This is simply to say that schools handle it the best way that they can at this time. But Senate Bill 602 would change that. It would require that Oregon Studies be taught in the 6th, 7th, or 8th grade. The school district can decide, for two semesters. This is at an age where students are better able to retain this information. Currently, committee members, 33 states teach the history of their state. 17 of these states teach more than one grade. And so, and the other 16 also teach history. Oregon has a unique history. We have put so much emphasis in our schools, and rightly so, on science and math, or in getting ready to prepare for the test, but we have ignored very much the Oregon studies, the civics, and the history. And those of us who serve in the Oregon legislature come here with a background of a love of history. Most all of my colleagues express that to me, and today you're going to hear from some people who share this same passion with me. And so I'm not going to say any more. I'm going to let you hear from a number of people, Chair Haas, who share the passion for getting history and civics and these other courses back into our Oregon schools. With me today is President Peter Courtney.
You would like,
and Senator Jason Atkinson.
Would you like me to join in?
I would.
Obviously, he does.
He does.
Okay.
When you guys are ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm State Senator Jason Atkinson. I am very honored to be here on this measure. I think it is very important, and I think that the good senator from Coos County has laid out a wonderful case. I will ask you all a question in my remarks. If any of you know who Fleetwood Lindley was. Does anybody here know who Fleetwood Lindley was?
Say the drummer, Fleetwood Mac.
Fleetwood Mac. Yeah, it's a Fleetwood Mac reference.
No, close. In the seventh grade, I was very interested in history, but one day our history teacher was sick, and so the principal of the school, Mr. Sheik, a person who's very important in my life, even today, filled in as a substitute, and he told the story of Fleetwood Lindley, after many attempts to steal Abraham Lincoln's body, the final mausoleum that he was placed in was constructed and overseen by Mr. Lindley, who, at the time when they were going to actually move the president's body, he took young Fleetwood, then 12 years old, the same age as I, as I heard the story, to open the casket and verify the body of Abraham Lincoln was in there. And that story has absolutely riveted me my entire life. Today, I have a degree in history. I share a particular passion with the good senators to my right about this building. And there's those little parts of touchstones in history that we have in our state that are very unique, not only in our state, but if you understand the history of Oregon, you understand the history of the United States. If we look at our own history, we can see things happening with the northern border that we have a memorial to. We have Lewis and Clark. We also have what happened in the creation of our state that most people don't realize. The cougar issue has been with us since the 1850s. We have the first vote at Shampooey Park. Direct election of United States senators started with five citizens in Oregon City getting around and eventually changing the entire United States Constitution. Women's suffrage, the initiative process during the Progressive Era when we joined with Wisconsin to create the initiative process. McNary, and the importance of McNary on Oregon history. Herbert Hoover, the only president of the United States to have lived in Oregon and scrawled his initials above Boone's Treasury in Salem when he used to attend the Salem Business College. The only domestic casualties of World War II happened in Oregon when the Japanese were floating bombs in the stratosphere that actually landed here. Our wonderful capital, and of course, there cannot be a teaching of Oregon history without the full explanation of the exploding whale. I think there is so many elements between art, architecture, civility, civil engagement, protest, bloodshed that is important for people to know. And I'm going to stop because there's far more eloquent remarks coming out of the fretful good Senate president to my right. But to say the least, this week I wrote a letter to my son. This is the first year he's not been with me during session. And it was for him to read this memorial of an explorer who mapped most of Oregon. And I said he was an explorer full of adventure just like you. And that may sound kind of, you know, touching from a father to a son. However, it was Mr. Sheik who used to write those same little notes to me from second grade, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, graduating from high school, graduating from college, being at my wedding, graduating from graduate school, always getting a letter from that one teacher revolving history that has been a huge lesson to me. Mr. Chair, I would urge a very positive vote.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson, and thank you for your efforts in teaching the history of this state, this building particularly, to so many young people. I don't think a lot of people know that you do those efforts and have made a tape. And thank you. Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Chair Hess and Vice Chair Morris, Senator Hsu, Senator George. Thank you for allowing me to come before the Senate Education Committee. It's an honor and privilege to appear before any legislative committee. I am Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem. I'm a state senator, District 11. When Senator Verger asked me to join on to this bill, I was struck by it because it is not uncommon, it's my understanding, and I believe if our research is correct, we know at least 33 states that require some kind of course in state history and culture and background. I remember in the hills of West By God, Virginia, there was a course and I studied it, and I have to admit I've forgotten a lot of it, but I am not proud of that, of about the state of, as I say, West By God, Virginia. I don't believe the importance of history can be overstated. If I had to live my life over again, I would do many things different, perhaps not even be here. But the fact is, I would not be a lawyer, and I would not have a master's degree in public administration or a bachelor's degree in political science. I would have gotten a PhD in history, because I believe that if you know history and really understand history, you know where we are today, not only in the history of this state, but in the history of this world, and you literally have the ability to see where we're going. And I have that kind of feeling about history. I just didn't. That was expressed to me by my father and by some of the nuns that taught me and others, but I had no idea what they meant. I simply memorized dates and stuff like that and wrote papers and did all that. But the magnitude of history cannot be overemphasized whether one gets their degrees in the natural or physical sciences or they get their degrees in what we call the social sciences. It cannot be overestimated, and I do not think any young person, particularly in those formative years, can get too much history, whether it's state history or American history or world history. And so this bill enters here with that in mind. And I prepare written testimony, as you all know. I always like to read written testimony when I speak on a bill. And I don't want to read from it. I just think that you have that in front of you. I believe it's a way of showing respect for the committee to leave written testimony, as well as to be sure that you understand the importance, I think, of this legislation. I don't know if I've ever done this before. I was asked to speak during the great celebration, our anniversary as a state, at the A.J. Ellison North Theater with the Salem Symphony. And they asked me to speak that night. I was terrified, and I came up with nuggets of Oregon history through Peter Courtney's eyes, and we researched this. I'm just going to give a couple nuggets. I've given one of the nuggets, and I won't repeat it in one of my speeches. I don't think I've ever done these nuggets before, and they fascinate me because they're just those kind of nuggets that even if you don't think you care that much about history, they fascinate you. For example, you may know about Charlie Darkey Parkhurst, who is well known as one of the most dexterous and celebrated of the famous stagecoach drivers from Portland to Sacramento. I mean, one of the greatest stagecoach drivers ever went by the name of Charlie Darkey Parkhurst. However, when One-Eyed Charlie died, it was discovered by the examining physician that Charlie wasn't a Charlie at all. So Charlie was a woman. And since she had voted in the 1868 election, may have been the first woman to vote in the United States of America full 53 years before suffrage. Now, that's not made up, folks. She was a woman driving these stagecoaches, but they thought she was a man. She passes away. God rest her soul. And when they examine, I'm not going to go into that, she turns out to be a woman. And she did vote. So that's a true story. I'm not making that up. Then I won't bore you further, but you know, we all know about the Oregon Trail and all that. What I didn't know, and I'm sure I can get you to look at the body language, I'm sure some of you know all about this, so allow me just to read this. I always thought, because I love Westerns, but I grew up in another part of the country, that this Conestoga wagon is what was used to get out here. Not true. Way, way, way not true. No, no. No. Because you see, the Conestoga was a huge, unwieldy wagon. They didn't use it. They couldn't have used it. Instead, the emigrants used a small farm wagons known as prairie schooners. Now, what's fascinating to me about this is they often built their schooners themselves, and they painted them blue and green. Now, I've yet to figure out where that came from. All my research, I don't know why they painted them blue and green, but they painted them blue and green. Although they appear simplistic, they're very sophisticated from an engineering standpoint. Why? Because they could easily turn corners. You can understand the mountains and everything else. They could easily turn corners because the front wheels were much smaller than the back wheels. So there was some real design going on here in these wagons, their size. The wagons measured only 4 feet by 10 feet. Now that is not a big wagon. With a bit of tar, it could be made watertight. Why? To float across rivers. And often they would load them with a ton of cargo. I can't imagine. But that is the story about the wagons that brought those peoples to this wonderful state, how they designed them just for our trail. They painted them, and then they even put tar on them so they could float them. So, I mean, those little bits of history, which I think would fascinate even the most brilliant engineer, or a biologist or chemist. That's the kind of thing that we would like our young people to be exposed to at a very young age. There's great benefits here. There's women's issues here. There's perseverance here. There's ingenuity here. There's trade here. It's the Oregon, my Oregon, over and over again. So, yeah, I'm all excited about what Senator Virgil asked me to do and what Senator Jason Atkinson attempted to try to figure out what she wanted to do. And so it's a privilege for me to be here. And so I thank you very much. And with that, I'll take any questions or comments that you may have of me or the team. We are a team.
We are. I'm going to, because we have so many people who want to speak, I'm going to move and ask the three of us. We have some people behind us that are waiting. Speaker Roblin.
Well, thank you all. And we do have Speaker Roblin and Senators Boquist and Johnson here.
Senator Johnson.
I hope you all
and Senator Boquist
appreciate how we managed to schedule this hearing on the same day that the Blue Book was released.
Yes.
It takes some
true brilliance.
Coordination of the chair. Actually, we wanted to do this on February 14th, the anniversary of the state. That fell on a Sunday, though. Welcome.
We're letting the higher chamber
go. Oh, well, thank you. For the record, Arnie Roblin, House District 9, representative. It is an honor to be here in front of Senator Haas, Chairman, Senator George, Vice Chair Morris, Senator Seals, it's been a while, and Senator Bonamici. Senator George was one of the student youth and government was here a couple weeks ago. He used to be a youth and government member, and so he understands a little bit about this chamber from a long time ago when he was in high school, and I appreciate that. Senator Virgie talked to me a while back about this bill and said, you know, I'm really concerned that it might have a fiscal that would cause it to have a problem. And I said, I can't understand why that would be the case. We teach history, we teach U.S. history, we teach all of those things in those grades, and all it is asking them to make sure that during that period of time, a semester or two semesters are actually taught about Oregon State history. I grew up in Washington, in which eighth grade Washington State history was taught, and it was actually history was not my favorite. Math was my class, but that was a class that everybody liked because you wanted to find out those special things about the state you lived in and those wonderful little things that would set your state apart from all the others. And in that time, middle school, it's a great time for kids to have that opportunity. And so my kids have actually commented more than a few times that they feel, when they have gone off to college and other places, at a disadvantage because all these other people came with a knowledge of their state that they didn't quite have. And we talked about a lot as we drove around the state, and we lived a few of the experiences that make Oregon unique. And I was listening to Senator Atkinson. The young woman and her husband, and she was killed by the Japanese, by the bomb, was one of my mother's high school classmates. They knew each other. It was an amazing event that took place in the war, and so my little town of Port Angeles knew about that event because of this church group that was there, and one of her friends was killed during the war here in Oregon. So that was always a part of our growing up. We had heard that one, understood it. And a couple of our teachers who live on the coast have actually found the little rings that they use for those explosive devices out in the woods in and around Coos Bay and Gold Beach, and we've had them in museums, and we've been able to see the what it actually happened during the Second World War. The other event happened shortly after we moved here, and my wife has always asked me, is that what they always do with whales in Oregon? And it was a pretty remarkable event in Coos Bay when that happened. And she said, what kind of a place did we move to? So I would love to have the explanation given to my children so they could explain to the rest of the world. I cannot imagine that it would really have costs. Most history teachers who teach in Oregon and the ones that I've talked to have a plethora of information about Oregon State history. There are books, there are other things you can get, but the real teaching of it is the enthusiasm that teachers bring to the subject. And my youngest daughter's one experience with Oregon State history was some elementary teachers who really did care about this stuff, and the kids got engaged in what it was. They dressed up, they got to understand who some historical characters were. She has always retained that, has that close connection with one of her teachers. She's now a writer, and you know, it is the stories that help us become who we are. And as Oregonians, I believe what you heard before, it's clear we need to pass that information on generation after generation, and the best way to do that is in schools, and I think this is the perfect time for that to happen as well. So I encourage this committee to pass it, to get over to the House so we can start looking at it, and I am pleased that Senator Verger put this forward for you guys to act upon.
Chairman Haas, Vice Chair Morse, distinguished colleagues and senators, happy to be here today. Joanne came to me and asked about going forth with this bill, and if I'd sign on, and you say one of the co-sponsors on it. And generally, I'm not overly in favor of mandates that come out. However, having said that, I sit in caucus every about 3 or 4 days a week, I think now, isn't it, Larry? And those of us who do not study history are doomed to repeat it. And it's funny, you sit in caucus and you don't know the Oregon legislative history, and you say, oh, well, we did that in the 05 session, or we tried that in the 02 session, and we didn't study it because, you know, people don't study the legislature. It's come before the committee, Mr. Chairman, we have a U.S. Constitution. We do a lot of study of that. We do very little state study of history, and it's kind of ironic because Senator Courtney, when we had the bicentennial address, if you remember, he made a speech during the opening of that session, and he talked about the Shampooey meetings. And when he got to the point of why the Shampooey meetings happened, I think Senator Haas and I will appreciate this, having sat through these hearings before, he brought up the issue the Shampooey meetings came about because they had a wolf problem, and they all wanted to get together and deal with the wolf and shoot the wolf. That was kind of ironic because of those days, Senator Haas and I were on the same committee, and we were talking about the wolf plan. So, and once again, it was an amazing portion of history to go back and look, because I never had that in school, of how all these things transpired and how they come together today. I kind of drew a little circle here because, you know, like history does repeat itself and it goes in a big circle, and those of us that don't say this find out that we're kind of left behind. I attended an event very recently. My wife does some reenactment stuff, and she dressed up as Mary Todd Lincoln. And Senator Morse was at this event, actually, and they asked that I should dress up because I have, as you know, some uniforms out there from the military, and so I did attend that event, and the eyes that came across that room when I walked into that event were rather startling. I was wearing a gray uniform of a militia major general from Oregon, and in fact, not only was he from Oregon, that particular individual is named... His namesake is Lane County. And at that point, everybody kind of looked across there, and I came dressed as Major General Joseph Lane, who is a militia two-star general. And, of course, I don't know how many people in here and the teachers behind us know the next thing I'm going to say is that General Lane, of course, was later, you know, a territorial governor and is most famous as being the vice presidential candidate with Stephen Breckinridge on the southern ticket running against Abraham Lincoln. And, of course, if Lane County knew that now, their lobbyists might be named something different. Having said that, the one thing I point out in this that is intriguing me more and more in education, and I'll leave this, and that's the second half, Mr. Chair, of your committee, and that's workforce development, and that is that I'm beginning to wonder, as we put these things forth that we'd identify that are important for our children to understand and important for the future of the state, that we don't do a unified curriculum on some of these. I always now ponder and say we have 198 school districts, we're going to put this out potentially, and we have all these other things, and 198 different ways of doing it, when it might be a whole lot more economical if we did it one way, especially in curriculum. And having said that, I'm going to turn it over to the good senator to my right, which is appropriate, and hopefully her guests have walked in because she told me to stall, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of being the state senator from District 16, and I was, in fact, stalling because I was bringing a visual aid to the committee. I will soon be joined by a group of journalism students from the Jewell School. But in their absence, I will proceed ahead. I feel it necessary somewhat to establish bona fides to have an opinion in this. I hold an undergraduate degree in history and have to say that my most provocative and influential teacher in all of my academic career was Isabel McCurdy, my high school history teacher. Today I feel a little as though I'm channeling my mother, who was also an English and Latin teacher until she enlisted in World War II. My mother's absolute conviction practically to her dying day was that students needed to have more history, more United States history. She thought it was shameful that a high percentage couldn't place the Civil War in the correct century, and certainly more U.S. history. And I will resist the temptation to elaborate after the tantalizing and thoughtfully laid out factoids by Senator Atkinson and President Peter by God Courtney. I believe that the chair has already pointed this out, but I think that the committee should take notice of the fact that this fine bill comes before you on the same day as the arrival of our new blue book and its 1911 companion. I believe this is a sign that this bill should move forward and become Oregon law. Frankly, I hate to disagree with my learned colleague, but I would like a mandatory element in the curriculum, and that is that it would have to have the whale tape as a part of any curriculum established for Oregon history. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before the committee.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, you have students who are going to come in and watch or participate?
No, I'm going to intercept them and we're going to head back.
Phil Lane, and we have some students. We'll flank you with students. Phil Lane.
Like
former Speaker
sure.
of the House.
Already.
Current.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Phil Lang from Portland, and as most of you know, I served for 18 years in the House of Representatives and was Speaker from 75 to 79. Several weeks ago, I had a conversation with Senator Verger about this bill, and I was a little bit shocked but interested, and one of the reasons I was shocked, if you see this book, it says Historic Oregon. And when I attended the public schools in Portland, it was a requirement in the eighth grade that we complete the history of Oregon, or you didn't get to the point where you were able to graduate from elementary school. In a family setting, it's important for them to have a framework for who they are, where their elders came from, were they farmers or teachers or loggers, and what they did for fun. It's also important for them to have a framework for the place in which they live, the state of Oregon. How did Oregon come to be? Who were the people who shaped our qualities and character, and how have Oregon rivers and mountains and the Pacific Ocean coastline affected crops, transportation, and whether communities have thrived or died out. I'm lucky enough to have lived in Oregon all my life and to have come from a pioneer family that made their way across the Oregon Trail in the 1840s. That heritage and the stories that were passed down in our family became important an integral part of growing up and my love for our wonderful state. For all these reasons, I'm here today to support Senate Bill 602 on behalf of the 6th, 7th, and 8th graders all over Oregon. I believe it is essential for a civil society to know about its history and to have an understanding of how the past influences and defines who we are as people and how and why this place developed as it did. During my 8th grade in Portland school system, we spent a year studying about Oregon and developing an understanding and pride for our state. I also realized that some will say that it's too difficult for school districts and classroom teachers to fit one more requirement into an already packed schedule. However, I would hope that the benefits and breadth of the description of Oregon studies, history, geography, economics, civics, municipal, county, tribal, and state government, and electoral and legislative process would lend itself to using Oregon's richness in any or all of these elements to create interesting, useful lessons for our young people. Lessons that help form the next generation of committed and engaged and knowledgeable citizens. I appreciate Senator Verger's and the other senators' efforts to move this idea ahead, and I hope you will give your support to Senate Bill 602. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, my name is Daniel Fuller. I'm a freshman at McNary, and I'm here today because my father, Daryl Fuller, is a lobbyist here, and this is a great way for me to get out of school. I'm also here to ask you to support Senate Bill 602. School is where we learn about our past to help us prepare for the future, and I've learned a lot about world history, specifically World War II and Adolf Hitler, and a lot of American history. We've had no Oregon history except for fourth grade, which wasn't very much. There's a lot about Oregon history which we can be proud of. We live in a great state, and we have a lot to learn about. High school graduates in Oregon should know our state motto used to be the Union. They should know that the initiative petitions to change the law was an idea and tried in Oregon, and they should know that the Oregon's past, future, and present depends on the beautiful state and how we are taught in our heritage, and that it also depends on using and protecting our natural resources. Oregon history from Lewis and Clark to the Bottle Bill is important, and I think that's why we should have more teaching.
Thank you.
Oh, just kidding. I'm sorry. I have more. sorry about that. We put together a survey of Oregon history questions and gave them to some students at McNary, and Dakota and I will share some of the results for that. 71% of those surveyed correctly identified 1859 as the year Oregon became a state. However, only 45% knew that Dr. John McLaughlin is known as the father of Oregon. Mark Hatfield, Jason Lee, and Thomas Jefferson all polled very strongly in this question. 71% of the students were aware that Oregon settled with the Union in the Civil War, which is why Oregon's original state motto was the Union. 61% also correctly identified Oregon City as the capital of Oregon prior to Salem. The survey asked students to identify how many of the following was Oregon first at: the initiative and referendum, a return deposit on bottles, vote by mail elections, and doctor-assisted suicide. Of course, you all know that Oregon was the first fall, all four. However, only 19% of the students marked initiative and referendum. Only 45% chose bottle return and doctor-assisted suicide. And only 39% knew Oregon was the first vote by mail state.
Chairman Haas, members of the committee, my name is Dakota Saunders, and I am a senior from McNary High School. I'm here to support Senate Bill 602, and unlike my good friend Daniel Fuller, I find this very interesting. To me, I was taught the basics of Oregon history, and even though I did learn some, politics has always been a favorite of mine, and when learning about Oregon history, I would like to know who represented us, both here at the state level and on the national level. Who represented us in the legislatures, who ran the legislatures, for certain people like Senator Hatfield, who served for over 30 years in the U.S. Senate, Dr. Kitzhaber, who has served 8 years as governor and serving a third term, and also former Governor Roberts, who to date and is our only first female governor. And like Daniel here, we've also conducted a survey, and only 6% of students at our school realized that former Senator Charles McNary was the 1940 vice presidential nominee. Bear in mind that we do go to a school named after the senator. Only 26% of students could identify one former governor of Oregon. Former Governor Kulongowski and Governor Kitzhaber were the only two that were mentioned. And I find this kind of awkward that no one at our school knew who Governor Roberts was. I was the only one in my class that did. So, one-third of the students knew that Oregon had 36 counties, and almost a third of students, again, knew that we had 5 seats in the House of Representatives. So, Chairman Hass, I'd like to thank you for allowing us to have this opportunity.
Now, if you would have asked them who won American Idol last week...
That could have worked, sir.
But your point is well taken. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Speaker Lang, thank you. Thank you. Questions or comments?
If any of you are interested in just browsing this book, I'll leave it with you and then collect it from your administrative assistant later.
That was your history book in 8th grade?
Right. Wow. It's sort of interesting.
Now, there's more history since it might be twice as thick now.
Probably wouldn't be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to Andrea Morgan from the department. So you can talk about how this will could be implemented or not and how it would work.
Chair House, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Autumn Wilburn. I'm the Legislative Director at the Department of Education. Thank you for having us here today to talk to you about social studies standards in Oregon and how they relate to Senate Bill 602. I'm joined today by Andrea Morgan. She is an education specialist at the department, specifically responsible for social studies standards, as well as many other areas.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Andrea Morgan, and I serve as the Social Sciences Curriculum Specialist for Oregon Department of Education. I'm in my 35th year as an educator. I taught high school before I went to the department. I was a history and economics teacher, so I've a long history with the standards in Oregon and working with them either as a classroom teacher or now as a curriculum specialist. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the standards in Oregon and the education and social studies that we get or that we give to our students. Since 1991, Oregon has had what is called a standards-based system. So we moved from the system of required courses where you sort of have an for lack of a better description, the empty box with a label that says that you will take a course in government, you will take a course in civics, you will take a course in history. And now we have instead these standards, which are descriptions of what students should know and be able to do at various grade levels. Right now, our current standards are written in a benchmark standard format, which means that it applies to grade bands. Benchmark 1 is grades kindergarten through grade 3. 2 is grades 4, 5. Benchmark 3 is grades 6, 7, and 8, and then high school standards. So they're written in that way. The new standards that we're working on for about the last 2 years, we've been in the process of reviewing and revising our current standards. Current standards were adopted in 2001. And since then, we have learned a lot about standards and how they should be developed and what they should provide for teachers and students. And so in this revision, as we've been working on it, we've been working with the Social Sciences Content and Assessment Panel. It's a panel of 35 educators who come from all grade levels, all parts of the state. In fact, we make sure that we really have representation from all the grade levels and from all areas to get a real representation of what's going on in Oregon. We also have others who sit in with the committee that work and act as advisors to give extra information as they've been developing the standards. We've been moving then to a core standards format, which we've already have those developed for mathematics and science. We were the next step in the revision process, and so we're moving to that as well, which means that we will have the core standards, which are basically the descriptions of prepared graduates in the various areas, but we'll also have grade-level standards. So instead of the benchmarks that cover a band of grades, we're going to have grade-specific standards. And I think this is going to make it much clearer in schools when things should be taught, what should be taught in order to meet those standards. As I said, we've been working for about 2 years. We are expecting right now for the final version to go before the State Board of Education in very late spring for their approval. But we have always incorporated the idea of Oregon Studies, and that's something that's near and dear to my heart. I'm a sixth-generation Oregonian. My family has artifacts on display at the McLaughlin House. History's very real to me. And so it's important that I see Oregon Studies represented in these standards as well. And I think we have done a really good job of that. We've focused in the current draft, the way the plan is looking right now, that there would be a focus. We're going to honor the tradition in Oregon where Oregon was taught in fourth grade. Actually, we're going to spend third grade in Oregon geography, and then we'll be doing Oregon history in fourth grade. However, that's not the only time that we expect Oregon to be taught, because educators and advisors to the content and assessment panel made it very clear that there are things that are appropriate at elementary school, there are things that are appropriate about Oregon to teach at middle school, and most importantly, there are some things that really need to be taught at high school as well. So students get a very deep understanding of their state, and not something that has to be just at a middle school level or just at an elementary level. And so the standards are being written with specific things that they need to do to make sure that they understand how Oregon does relate in terms of geography, economics, civics. We've been working very closely. You'll see if in the written testimony, we've had a number of groups that have also advised us with some written drafts in reaction to our first draft of the standards. You'll notice that Classroom Law Project, the 21st Century Education.org, Advocates for Personal Financial Education, the Oregon Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, the Oregon Heritage Commission, Government to Government, all have been instrumental in forming these new standards and making sure that we have the components that make Oregon Studies fully developed and implemented within the standards K-12. Because again, we believe that the study of Oregon isn't something that should be just at 1 year and one grade. We think it's something that is ongoing, and it's something that has to be developed over time. If you have any questions about our standards, I'd be happy to answer those.
Thank you. I think it would be helpful for you to kind of put in perspective how much Oregon history is taught now versus how much would be taught under this change.
Okay. At this point, because we are a local control state and because of the way the standards are written, we don't give a prescribed time limit for meeting those standards. But if they can provide that instruction to students and show that they've provided that instruction, it's up to the local district to develop the particular curriculum and how that instruction is delivered. Right now, that is part of state statute. And so we provide the standards that say what students should know and be able to do. It's up to the districts how long it takes in order to do that. Again, I think it's the number of statements and the specificity of the statements that are going to make a difference in terms of the amount of time. Right now, I think all of you are aware that there's somewhat of a crisis in terms of social studies instruction of all kinds, that we've seen with the advent of No Child Left Behind. We're seeing less and less time being spent for the social studies and all of those areas, geography, civics, history, and economics, because we're spending more time teaching reading and math because those are required assessments. We've got more studies coming in all the time. The Fordham Foundation just recently released a study that talked about the decrease in instructional time in those areas. I mean, that's something that we're all dealing with, and it's something that we're all concerned about, I think. But the main thing is it is up to those districts how long it's taught. Most of our districts right now spend the fourth grade doing Oregon history. And so some portion of their instructional time during that year is when students study Oregon specifically. However, instruction to those other standards come at other grade levels.
Which accounts for why we see all the fourth graders field trips here.
Yes.
Questions or comments? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 602. Thank you, Senator Berger, for your help, and we'll see where this goes. And I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 291. There's a short summary.
Certainly. Senate Bill 291 creates an expanded learning opportunities 2011 task force comprised of 26 volunteer members appointed by the governor, Senate, and House.
Okay, and we have a couple of people who have already made appearances here, including our own Senator Bonamici. Would you like to weigh in?
Thank you. I would, thank you. But the other people should be coming up at the time while I'm speaking, because I just have a few comments to make. Mr. Chair, this is another bill that came from the Supporting Student Success group that has been meeting over the last 18 months. And as I explained, we've been looking at extended learning opportunities across the state, and we've done a significant amount of work, not me personally, but the people at the panel have done a tremendous amount of work mapping those and figuring out where the programs are geographically, how they're funded. But we believed that our work had just begun, and with the importance of extended learning opportunities, we thought it was critical to continue the work and to continue looking at where the extended learning opportunities are, how they're funded, and hopefully you'll understand after you hear the testimony the benefit of continuing this work. And I know some people have hesitated about task forces, but I'm convinced, and I put this bill request in as a committee bill, Mr. Chair, because I'm convinced that this is a very, very important task for our state. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. Beth Unverzad, Oregon After School for Kids. So it was with the help and support of the National League of National Council of State Legislators, Chief State School Officers, and National Governors Association, that we were able to spend 18 months with some direct support from those organizations and the support of the wonderful members of the study group to look at expanded learning opportunities. We did develop a database. We've cross-referenced. We've talked to schools and programs, and we have truly just started this work. For the first time, we actually know where programs are, how many children are being served, what age groups and locations. And there are some clear things that have come out of this process. We have submitted to you the Supporting Student Success Report, so hopefully you'll have a little bit of time to take a look at it and see what we learned and what the recommendations were. So one of the recommendations was the establishment of the task force, and we're pretty clear on the next steps and directions that we would like to take. One of the critical components that we learned, which I think is why we're here in front of Senate Ed, is that we identified 800 programs that operated at least 3 days a week, 12 hours or more. 673 of those programs operate on school premises. So my feeling is this is a missed opportunity for coordination, for support, and for direct connection for school reform. So I'm going to turn it over to a couple of people who come in support of this. There are many others who will be sending you additional testimony. So I'll turn it over to you. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Karina Lemons, and I am here today with a number of hats that will help you understand the perspective from which I sit. I am currently serving my 8th year as elected to the Salem-Keizer School Board, and 41,000 students in our enrollment, making us the second largest school district in Oregon. I am also a member. I represent Oregon as the ambassador to the National After School Alliance. I also had the privilege of serving with the Senator and Beth on the Supporting Student Success Task Force. And I also have the unique role of serving as the Executive Director for the Salem-Keizer Education Foundation. And one of the most significant programs and services and a lion's share of our budget in our foundation is providing the Enrichment Academy, the expanded learning opportunities for our middle school programs and four of our elementaries. And I have provided you a little bit of information on the program profile and also relates to a number of the other pieces of information you've heard today. One of them that may also help you is because of our extended learning opportunities, we qualify for the Federal Supper Program you heard before. We were responsible because of this to serving 60,000 hot suppers to children last year. With those perspectives, Salem-Keizer School District is in the midst of looking at a $55 million shortfall in our general fund. Last year it was a $28 million cut. The year before it was a $27 million cut. With my school board hat on, and specifically with my foundation hat on, we went out to our community, we went to our teachers, we went to our parents, and we said, in my words, what's the hill you want me to die on? What is the hill that is so important that we don't let lapse and we as a community come forward and say we can't replace the 600 teaching positions that may be lost. We can't replace some of those, but what can we as a community protect? Overwhelmingly, extended learning opportunities, the after-school programs, and the information I gave you provides why they do that as far as academic success, reducing crime, keeping children safe, and reducing hunger. Senate Bill 291 is an incredible piece. It fills a gap, actually it's a hole or a gaping canyon, of information. As you all know, we live in a world of data. Information shapes the decisions we make. Data and information is power. The profession of after school deserves the same amount of attention on data and information that the rest of our organizations and the rest of our institutions do. Completing this task force will provide us that information. It will give us the things that we need to do to make best practice-based decisions. It will allow us to speak in one voice in our state. It will allow us to align all the acronyms, and it will allow us to empower and hold up programs like you heard previously about how extended learning is so important to the nutrition element of our children. It is so important in our community that we have actually created our own alliance, and it's chaired currently by former Marion County Sheriff Raul Ramirez, and we have a Marion Polk Medical Society, Dr. Gilbert, leading the leadership, and we also have a member of our alliance with us to speak further on the incredible importance of Senate Bill 291 in moving our profession forward.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Holly Fifield, and I'm here today representing Stand for Children, as well as a partner with the After School Alliance that Karina spoke of. For the past 8+ years, Stand for Children, our local chapter, has advocated for quality extended education opportunities. And with Oregon having the second shortest school year in the nation, we think that quality extended learning opportunities are and access for children is essential, and it's essential to support the learning that they're getting in the classroom, and we think that that's a necessity. So in Salem-Keizer District alone, we have over 41,000 students, and close to 10,000 of them are accessing the after-school programs. And due to our proposed budget cuts that Karina spoke of, we are actually looking at cutting our after-school programs. We understand that we're in tough economic times and we have to be efficient. And we believe that the recommendations in Senate Bill 291 align with this need. It looks at improving revenue and spending efficiency while also leveraging community partnerships. And this will increase the capacity in which we can serve children and will promote sustainability. So beyond what I just spoke of, I know the type of extended learning opportunities that this bill promotes will also support working families, will promote nutrition, address hunger, and help to keep kids and the community safe during the high crime times of 3 to 6 p.m. So thanks for letting me testify.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair. Thank you. One of the things that I wanted to point out that was so surprising to me when I was serving on this group is that the number of funding sources for the extended learning opportunities, and I think Beth might have, or Karina might have the details on that, but it was really surprising how many different sources of funding there are for these programs. And part of the work of this task force is to continue to look at all of those and get some coordination. So hopefully in the future we'll have more extended learning opportunities. If you want to respond to that just a little bit.
Yes. So at Northwest did a review of federal funding streams that come to Oregon and that are available within the world of after school. And so they're very divergent, and they actually are from the Corporation of National Service, U.S. Department of Education, U.S. Department of Agriculture, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, U.S. Department of Justice, and U.S. Department of Labor. So we actually already know where those are, and we know who the players are. We don't have all of the details of information that we need to have and the conversations that we need to have around the alignment of those funding streams. We have, as the network, had people from Department of Education on our steering committee for the last 5.5 years, from Department of Human Services, from the corporation. So they're all very well aware of this, but it's going to take the work of the task force to actually sit down, look at, talk about the alignment of these funding streams, because one of the problems that we see is we'll have a program that will have up to 23 different funding streams. So every place that they get money, so Weed and Seed, which is juvenile justice, or Department of Ed, every single one of them have different kinds of outcomes. They have different kinds of reporting processes. We would like to tackle that. We would like to analyze that. So that, and then there are local investments that are huge. So City of Portland has the $7 million that go to after-school programs in the City of Portland. We've seen local levies. So we'd like to take a look at that and have a picture of what that looks like so we can see what the investments are. We also understand from our conversations in our Supporting Student Success Report that there are barriers, and we've identified what those barriers are. We would like to figure out a way and a process to help both programs and local communities with those barriers, transportation being one of the major ones that was identified by all of the superintendents that I spoke to. I spoke to 21 different superintendents around the state that were identified as the highest poverty, highest minority school districts, about expanded learning opportunities, about their vision and how they might see this working connected to the school day.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 291. Senator Bonamici, you're kind of driving this train, and you had this amendment. Can you refresh us?
There were just some technical changes. I'll let Beth do that. There's some just sort of technical changes of the task force members.
Let me go to
I think we don't have
a work session on Senate Bill 291. No, we don't have a work session.
We don't have a fiscal on the dash one.
But if we could adopt the amendment just to keep it straight.
Beth, would you like to summarize? Do you have the amendment in front of you?
The amendment had just a few changes to it, and membership, so Oregon PTA came to us and said they would like to participate.
Okay.
And
The Oregon Recreation and Park Association also came to us and asked to participate. We also spoke to and got support from the Oregon Applied Science Initiative at the Oregon University System, so the Chancellor's Office would like to participate. So that's good news. They want to be at the table.
Okay, so why don't we do that, Senator Morris?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 291, dated February 28, 2011.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated February 28, 2011 to Senate Bill 291. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Any objection? Seeing none. The Dash 1 amendment is adopted to Senate Bill 291, and we will have to wait until we get our fiscal report before we can vote on this.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 291. I know time is running out here, but I do want to get started on Senate Bill 745 and see how far we go. So let me open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 745. If you could give us a summary, Linda.
Certainly. Senate Bill 745 allows a student to attend school in a school district where the student does not have legal residence if the student receives written consent from the school district where the receiving school is located, and if the student provides written notification to the district where the student has legal residence. This bill does provide an exception for school districts larger than 45,000 students.
Okay, and Senator Boquist is here with a constituent.
Twice in one day.
Yeah, it was a long day. Well, we had several legislators speak on a previous bill that were windy and sort of pushed us back.
That's all history now, Mr. Director. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Brian Boquist, Senate District 12. As all of you know, as senators, constituents come into your office and ask you to bring forward issues, and many times, you know, there are complex issues, and trying to figure out what's going on, and you help them out and kind of bring them forth in the process. I must say that in four terms, I've never had such a tenacious constituent as Beth Cook, who's here with me. And Beth brought an issue before us. I didn't know how to resolve it. We were trying to resolve it different ways. And I hearkened back to the House and said, well, Betty Comp knows more about this than I do. And so Representative Comp came in and kind of started down the process. And, of course, neither one of us had time to approach this. Senate Bill 745, which Beth is going to explain to you, and I'm going to, unfortunately, as with some constituents, have to abandon her because today's kind of a zoo in a circle. I have passing out to you kind of the crux of the issue. The committee administrator outlined it fairly succinctly. Beth can give you a whole bunch of details, some statistical analysis. The article you have coming around before you is actually an article that's out in Ohio, in which we're a much more civilized state. We aren't Wisconsin, we're not Ohio, but out in Ohio, a mom got caught sending her child to a different school district, and so she was sentenced to two consecutive five-year prison sentences, which in the end were suspended, and the governor out there is talking about a pardon for that. We, of course, like to do things a little bit different. We have state senators and representatives. We bring our constituents before committees like this one, Chairman Haas, and let them plead their case and have their presentation before them. I do know that there has been multiple amendments. This thing's kind of evolved. It was on and off again. And I know that the Oregon Department of Education has made suggestions for potential amendments in the future. Having said that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to let Beth take over. She's got some quick bullets. I know you're on a time constraint, and then we'll kind of progress from there. And unfortunately, I have got to be in another hearing 5 minutes ago, too. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the courtesy to my constituent.
Thank you. Ms. Cook, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Beth Cook, and for the record, I live in Yamhill County, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 745. I requested the bill in July 2009, so it's been a little bit of a road in a process to get here, so I'm very excited to be here. My story. My son Josh was born with some sensory issues, and they were identified fairly early on. We were able to access, through a wonderful pediatrician, great occupational therapy, a wonderful preschool at Linfield, some services that he needed to kind of get him forward. And the goal during his entire life was to get him ready for a traditional school setting. They put it as he needed a beach entry rather than being dropped in the 12-foot section, but to basically explain it, he was the 18-month-old at the Mommy and Me music class with his hands over his ears in the corner, rocking himself, wouldn't make eye contact, tactile sensitivity. We worked really hard to get him further along. And by the time it was time, close spring term before kindergarten, we were there almost, but the occupational therapist said, he would be better served by a smaller environment to continue for kindergarten. So I approached a local district and was met with very strong resistance about even applying for an interdistrict transfer. There were no other smaller schools within our existing district, but there were three within our commute routes, other public schools and other districts that would have been absolutely wonderful options for us. And I asked the question, what is this? Why would there be such resistance to this? And I was told, well, it all comes down to money. As a parent who had spent 5 years by that point trying to make sure that this child had gotten to a certain point, I had to ask the question again, well, what about Josh? And they said, well, we're sure he'll survive. That was not my goal for that child. And it shouldn't be a goal for any child. I mean, he was close to where he needed to be. All he needed was a smaller environment. It was not, special services. So at that point, I just had another baby. I was getting ready to go back to work. I did not have the bandwidth to bang my head against a wall. They had told me they wouldn't accept the application until August. And so I only had mere weeks before school started, and child care issues and those kinds of things to deal with. So I got my checkbook out and wrote tuition checks for private school. And as I saw him do well, it kept me up at night because there were public school options available. It shouldn't have been a matter of whether or not I could pull out a checkbook. And I come from a blue-collar background in which most of my family and my friends would not have been able to make that choice. For us, it meant fewer vacations. For them, it would have meant food on the table. And so I went back again in 2009 thinking, okay, well, I'd paid for the tuition for that first year. They're not getting money now. It's not going to be as much of an issue. And was met with similar resistance. He suggested that we try an individual learning plan, something along those lines. We knew that a smaller environment by that point really was what he needed, and it was working for him, and I didn't feel that he should have to be put in a situation where he failed before getting the services that he needed. By that point, I had spoken to dozens of families throughout the state, found out that this is not about one district. This is not about one child. This is not about one family. This is a statewide issue that we face frequently. I was told, lie about my address. Just lie. No problem. Here's an address you can use. I was not willing to send my 5-year-old to school lying about where he lived every day. And I don't think I understand parents who meet that brick wall. I understand where they feel that they have to make that choice, but I don't think that that's an adequate choice for us to be providing underneath our system. But as I said, this is not about one child. There might be there are parents who work many miles from home who want to attend they want their child to attend school closer to where they might live, where they might work, so that they can be more involved during the school day. Children who need a smaller or larger setting for any number of reasons. The variety has been significant to me. I've seen there's just so many different areas where people have, reasons why they might want to choose these options. Children who fail to thrive in one school but succeed in another. This is not about better or worse. This is about learners who have different styles and the fact that we can do more under our existing system to provide options for parents. I spent 12 of the last 15 years working in higher education. Part of that time was as a program manager in continuing education, and so often I had students coming, oh, no, I was a terrible student in high school, I was a terrible student, I've never succeeded. But then when they found the right fit, it was this epiphany, and it was just amazingly successful for them. So I got to see that from an adult perspective. I helped co-found the Community Higher Education Consortium. It's a group of over 30 local colleges and universities that work together in the Portland metro area for adult learners who work in various companies. And we work together to help find a good fit for individual students. So we're competitors, but at the same time, we work together to make sure that students find the right fit. You're going to hear fears about destabilization of the system when it comes to this issue, but the fact is, nationally, fewer than 1% of parents take advantage of this option when it's made available. The positive impact on parental satisfaction rates is much higher. Districts that have taken the step of offering these transfers willingly say they would never go back, it's not that big a deal. It's not, I mean, once you get beyond that resistance and you actually start working with the parents, it's actually, you know, they found that the positive impact on the culture of their districts is tremendous. The Oregon School Board Association has a policy that is much more lenient than many of the districts currently enact, but they don't have a mandate to be able to force districts to use their own, to use that suggested policy. It all boils down to this. We don't hear enough good things about Oregon's education system. We always hear about the need for more accountability in terms of teachers. I would argue that we also need to more fully engage parents as partners in their children's education. Senate Bill 745 provides a more equitable interdistrict transfer process for our K-12 system. No longer will there be a question if parents will or will not have this option based on where they may live. As Senator Boquist already mentioned, the Oregon Department of Education has already recommended two minor amendments to the bill, and I've requested those from Legislative Council. One would relate to special education students, and it would delete the portion that states state school funding for the purposes of state school funding underneath ORS 339.133. And the other would direct the department to develop a list of reasons districts cannot deny entry for interdistrict transfer students to ensure consistency and that there will be no form of discrimination. I would like to note that there is no additional state funding required for this to be enacted. We have the system. It's just about utilizing our existing resources as effectively as we possibly can. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. I just wanted to applaud you for not going the route of the woman who the article is about. As a parent in a district that has magnet programs, I heard many a story of people finding ways to get their kids into the schools that they wanted to, and I applaud you for not going down that path. I think it says a lot about your values. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And your son now?
He turned 8 on Tuesday, and we saw him in private school. I sold my house on Monday, so we're looking for a new district, and it was due to a job change, not due to just to this, but it is one of the questions that I'm calling every single place where we look at schools to ask, what is your interdistrict transfer policy? Our goal is that he will be attending the resident school that we move into next year, but just in case, I want to know that I don't have to come up against this again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Athletics are a big part of education. Where would be the, I guess you might say, the boundaries for recruitment for the, you know, the best basketball team, the best football team, the best whatever?
Well, and what I have found in speaking with people is that the athletes currently have no issues getting these transfers, that the coaches talk to each other, they kind of work things out. So I have found that that's not really, I mean, I'm happy that if we wanted to add an amendment saying that students couldn't play sports for a certain time period, I'm happy to do that. But I found that from the discussions I've had that the athletes currently are the ones that do not have problem getting the transfers. So. And there are rules that OSA already has in place. And I've contacted them. If they have suggested language, I'd also be more than willing to have that included.
Well, thank you. We very much appreciate your thoughtful testimony here. We're going to listen or hear from some other folks before we close. And we'll keep you posted.
Thank you very much.
Lori Wimmer and Morgan Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Wanted to talk a little bit about this bill today because it's a pretty significant change to enrollment policies for students in our public schools. I'm sure, as most of the committee members know, currently you can attend a school in another district through an interdistrict transfer agreement where both districts talk about that and agree to release the student. There's also the charter law, which allows students to attend charter schools in other districts if there is space. But this bill would add a new pathway to the students, allowing students to attend schools in another district that will accept them without the resident district having an opportunity to be part of that discussion. And I think Senator Morse raised one point. Our organization and our members are concerned really about five things that we would hope you would consider, five policy questions that we hope you consider as you think about this bill. The first is equity and opportunity and equity and process. There are about a dozen states that have open enrollment policies in the nation, and many school districts in Oregon allow you to transfer within your own district to other schools. And the one thing they all have in common is they have some sort of open application process where anybody, whether you're a special education, English language learner, you've had discipline problems in the past, whatever your reason for transfer, you have an equity of opportunity. And this bill doesn't have a system for that. It just allows any district that will take a student to sort of pick and choose through the students that may come to them. And we're concerned about equitable access to process. And the question that we hope you would consider is, you know, should individual school districts have the ability to choose who they accept into their schools? The second policy question is around student transportation. Under the current state school funding formula, if this bill were to go into law, if the students that are attending district in another community, for example, if a parent lives in Portland and they want to enroll their kid in Salem-Keizer and Salem-Keizer takes them, the Salem-Keizer school district could be reimbursed for the cost of providing transportation to those students. And so we have a concern about how this may impact transportation costs for school districts. If you look at other states that have open enrollment policies, they have basically a mandate that the parents have to provide the transportation for the students. And that raises some equity questions for our members. Should, the question is about parents who may not be able to afford transportation costs or whether the state should be providing the transportation to those students. So that's another concern we hope you consider. The third policy question we hope you consider is criteria for entrance. Should it be based on academic opportunities? Should it be reserved for students who may have a safety issue from bullying or harassment? Should it be allowed for convenience to parents? Should students who transfer be allowed to participate in extracurricular activities, particularly competitive ones like speech and debate or athletics? Or should there be no criteria for this type of policy? Another thing that's critical for school board members, and to be very frank, in these tough financial times, many of our members are concerned about losing students to other districts and being able to provide a comprehensive quality education for the students that remain in their school district. School boards are concerned about any new unpredictability in enrollment numbers that will impact hiring and curriculum decisions, and this is particularly true for our small, rural, and remote school districts. So we would ask you to consider, should schools, be allowed to market their schools to districts and families in adjoining districts? Should there be limits on how many students attend the districts outside of their own? Should districts be allowed to plan for capacity or build new schools in hopes of attracting students from other districts? These are all the types of policy questions that we hope you consider as you think about this. And the final question that's of paramount importance is for school board members is, we already have a local process, and I've had a couple conversations with Ms. Cook, and we've shared our information and what we recommend to our school boards. And we hope you consider the local control element of this as well. The interdistrict transfer process, we believe, works for the vast majority of students, and we all have anecdotes about people who may have not been well served by that process. So instead of scrapping that local process, where both the districts have the ability to weigh in on that, perhaps we need to add an appeal to the State Board of Education or have the state superintendent review that, rather than going completely the other direction, scrapping that local control process and going to open enrollment. So the other curiosity about this bill is it exempts Salem-Keizer and Portland and possibly Beaverton. Beaverton might be right on the edge of this from having to release two districts, and possibly three districts would still be able to deny students from leaving their district. So that is a curiosity to us. So if you're considering looking at this bill further, we'd ask about that, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. You guys, go ahead. Please note our time. I don't mean to squeeze you to the end here, but
I'm sorry.
Please note our time. We're going to
get
out of it.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Mr. Chairman, I will just submit to you written testimony from Mary Alice Russell, the superintendent of the McMinnville School District, which is the one that was discussed by Ms. Cook. I will tell you that if you can take the time to read it, and I'm sorry, Superintendent Russell was here all yesterday afternoon to testify on exactly the same bill in the House and was just unable to give us 2 days away from the school district. But I think you'll find a substantially different story, a substantially sensitive school district to the kinds of issues raised by Ms. Cook. I've listened to the testimony twice.
twice because we've had the pleasure twice, and it really is a different story. I hope you'll take the time to look at the superintendent's testimony, look at the very liberal and comprehensive intra-district, inside the district transfer policy, as well as the inter-district transfer policy, with the substantial of number of reasons that a student may leave the district. Take a look at a packet of statistics regarding the McMinnville and surrounding school districts. You'll find McMinnville also has a very liberal transfer record. Ms. Chairman, this is an unjustified bill. This is a bill coming at you, I think, at least from the perspective of McMinnville. We may see in the future another story from another constituent. I deal with these constantly on behalf of members of the legislature who call me and say, how come that superintendent won't let this child go? Most commonly, it's for athletic teams. Sometimes it's something else. But most commonly, it's because somebody wants to play on the neighboring athletic team because the coach is better, the access to a college team is more likely. There's a whole bunch of reasons these occur. And I just would ask you to really stop on this one and take a very close look at what's being asked, why it's being asked, who's asking it, and what their options really were. So we'll submit the written material. We'll provide you with, I think, a look at a variety of other folks who have made application and been very successful with the McMinnville School District. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association, and we too did try to meet with Ms. Cook in the interim, as my colleagues have, to see if there was a way to problem solve different from just opening up the door to open enrollment altogether. But I gave you copies of both the state and federal statutes around transfer opportunities. Additionally, besides the traditional attendance area schools, a student can get the assessment based transferred under ORS 328-329-45, the NCLB-related transfers. Charter school has open enrollment. Magnet and alternative placements are possible. Special education transfers and placements are also open. Expanded options and other dual enrollment programs are other options. And then, of course, always private schooling and homeschooling are options for families. So it is not that we don't already have quite a few different directions for students, but we think opening the door altogether, as you've heard, with all the concerns that come with that, is a complete and total departure from the ability of districts to, on behalf of all students served in the state of Oregon, manage responsibly, especially in these times with limited funds. And I know you're packing it up, so I'll just end there.
Sorry. Is that obvious? Questions?
Sure. Hey, Chuck, specifically on this case, I think that Ms. Cook went to private school. I mean, she solved the problem herself. I think the question here is not an issue-by-issue case. It doesn't appeal to me emotionally. I'm looking at this from a public policy perspective. So please don't think that we're looking at this from an emotional perspective. We want to fix this problem for one student. The problem that I think all of us hear is we have parents who don't feel served. Their child is not served in the school district where they are. And they want options. And what we care about is all of the students and their individual needs. And if a parent makes a decision that their student would be benefited by a transfer to another public school where they would have better opportunity, the public policy case is, I don't really care about Ms. Cook's problem, to be perfectly honest. So she shipped her kid off to private school, great, it's even better for her. But for everybody else that may not have the opportunities that Ms. Cook has to send her kid to private school, this is a big deal. I mean, this is not to be taken lightly, like, oh, it's an emotional issue. This is a big deal to every one of these parents, especially those who are blue-collar families in poor situations, may not be able to, you know. And I just think that the three of you are, I mean, just say it, it's a little bit of like the establishment education saying no all the time. And I want you guys to encourage you guys to say yes at some point. This is one of these situations where I think we can find a solution and allow a lot more open enrollment type situations, and especially if we make it for low to income families who are in tough situations, that we give these parents the opportunity to save their children. We have heard in this committee, I don't know how many times, that education is the key indicator for the future of that child. And I'm tired. I've only been on this committee for a month. I'm tired of the establishment always telling me why we shouldn't change things and the status quo is okay. I got to tell you what, status quo is just not okay. It's just not. And so, I mean, I guess from my perspective is, rather than come up here and I wrote down all the objections, they don't seem fixable. So let's fix them. And let's give people a chance to have a better ability to move between schools. Because even though they have these options, we're still getting complaints. We're still hearing people saying, I'm not able to move between schools. And all I'm asking you guys, the three of you, to do, put on your thinking caps, go out, let's solve this problem, let's move a bill that actually helps parents move between and have a closer to an open enrollment process. And if you want to put in some sideboards, fine, but let's get an open enrollment process that we like.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'd like to take that on just because I think that we did try to come up with a solution outside of just saying no. And I think that, I've been in this building 21 years, and I've watched legislatures tell the education community to be better fiscal managers, to try to audit school districts on performance as well as fiscal audits, to do all sorts of things. And on one hand, there's the wagging finger of do a better job with money management, irrespective of the amount we give you. And then on the other hand, it's, wait a minute, when we want to do things that may in some way compromise the ability to have some money management tools, then we're told that we're being obstructionist. We're simply trying to bring information to you as you make your decision that shares with you the implications for districts of any particular course of action.
Well, I'm going to make that the final word. We'll continue this conversation. Appreciate you all coming.
Thank you.
Committee, thank you. We are adjourned.